Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy.
Hello and welcome to my channel, Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a relatively new channel, The Geeky Christian, which is run by Dr. Sean Nelson. No, not the Sean Nelson who stole a tank and drove it around San Diego in 1995, the Sean Nelson who co-authored Evidence of an Early New Testament Canon with Norman Geisler, a prominent theologian who advocated for teachers to be allowed to teach young earth creationism in the classroom, despite not believing in a young earth himself, and believing that tying the age of the earth to one's faith as a requirement would inevitably lead more people away from the church than towards it. Kinda odd that he'd argue in favor of young earth creationism if that's his stance, but whatever. In this video, Dr. Nelson gives us what he says is the best evidence for Jesus' resurrection. So let's take a look!
Okay, so the entire Christian faith comes down to one event being true or not, and that event is Jesus' resurrection.
Yep. I mean, notably, even if Jesus did come back from the dead, that doesn't automatically make Christianity true, but proving that he did certainly would be a massive step in the right direction.
Here are the top five reasons for the resurrection. Number one, the detailed eyewitness testimony of the events.
We actually have zero eyewitness testimony to the events. What we do have are accounts that don't even pretend to be eyewitness testimony, which record the story as believed by various communities of early Christians, which include conflicting details, differing portrayals of Jesus, and just outright contradictions. Oh, yeah, and the earliest of these accounts was written down some 30 to 40 years after Jesus would have been crucified.
This is what they said happened. Jesus was arrested. He was beaten, whipped, they drove nails through his hands and feet, he then died by crucifixion.
Okay, so far, even if I grant all of that, he doesn't stand out from your typical criminal in the Roman Empire that suffered the exact same fate.
He was confirmed dead when they stabbed him with a spear.
Interestingly, the only account that has him stabbed with a spear to check and see if he was dead is the one that has clear theological motivations to avoid having any of his bones broken. Since it's a relatively common occurrence for crucifixion victims to have had their legs broken, John used it as a part of his explanation for why the bodies were taken down early. Pilate, in the biblical stories, shows quite a bit of deference to the Jewish customs, and acts as though the Jewish authorities are actually authorities over him. He sends Jesus to be judged by the Jewish monarch, Herod, before passing judgment himself. He tries to free Jesus, but is pressured into executing him by the Jewish leaders. He follows the Jewish custom of releasing a prisoner at Passover, despite there being no non-biblical reference to such a custom ever existing. So, with that character of Pilate established by the Bible, it makes sense that when the Jewish leaders asked that no bodies be hanging on crosses during Passover, that Pilate would give in to that request. So, John kills two birds with one spear. By having the legs of the two criminals broken so that they would hurry up and die and their bodies could be taken down, while simultaneously making a point of not having any of Jesus' bones broken.
His body was wrapped in 75 pounds of cloth and sealed inside a tomb.
This is the part of the story where I begin to have more significant disagreements with how it's normally presented. Up until now, it's a fairly normal crucifixion, even if there is some theology woven into the story. Like, Pilate probably didn't allow the Jews to have crucifixion victims removed for Passover, especially since leaving the bodies to rot for a while was not only a part of the punishment for the victim, but was meant to serve as a warning to others. So we have part of the story that becomes less believable, that Pilate would have agreed to end multiple people's sentences early in order to appease the Jewish leaders, and that the Roman soldiers in charge of breaking the legs would have cared about not breaking Jesus' legs because he was already dead. And then we have Joseph of Arimathea taking his body and putting it in a tomb. Typically, crucifixion victims would be thrown into mass graves after they had been left out to rot. If this had happened to Jesus, then it's entirely understandable why nobody was able to produce his body after the crucifixion. Nobody even knew which body it was. It would have been unrecognizable. And given that the earliest writings that discuss Jesus' resurrection make no mention of a tomb burial, with Paul only mentioning that he had, in fact, been buried, the tomb seems like a fairly late addition to the story. So we have the tomb burial showing up decades after the first writings about Jesus, and a theologically motivated spear stabbing that shows up even later still. Yeah, forgive me for not being confident in these particular claims.
16 Roman soldiers guarding the tomb left their posts.
Where did you get that from? That's not even how the biblical story goes. First, the soldiers at the tomb are only mentioned in Matthew, which makes for a curious omission from the other Gospels. Seems like a pretty important detail to leave out, especially given that the author of Matthew all but explicitly states that the Roman guards were inserted into the story specifically as a counter to the claim that the disciples stole Jesus' body. Matthew has the soldiers run to the chief priests, weird thing for Roman soldiers to do, in order to report the appearance of the angels, the rock being rolled away, and the disappearance of Jesus. The chief priests then bribe the soldiers to lie, saying that they fell asleep at their posts, a crime that would result in their being executed. Apologists will tell you that the disciples really believe because they wouldn't die for a lie when, in their own story, there are soldiers who have to be willing to die for a lie in order for the story to be true. Oh, but of course the chief priest says that they'd keep the guards out of trouble, as if the Jewish leaders had any authority over the punishment of Roman soldiers. Anyway, my point is that the guards never left their posts. According to the book of Matthew, they were there the whole time and then lied about falling asleep at their posts. So, can we really trust what you're saying about this story when you don't even seem to be familiar with the story that you're supposed to be defending?
The huge stone door was rolled away.
And this is where we encounter one of the many contradictions with how the story is told in the Gospels. Was the stone rolled away before or after the women arrived at the tomb? Did they see it get rolled away? According to Mark, Luke, and John, it had already been rolled away when they arrived at the tomb. In Matthew, an angel comes down and rolls it away while they are watching, accompanied by an earthquake. These are not compatible stories with different details being provided depending on the perspective of the storyteller. This is a flat-out contradiction. The stone cannot both have been rolled away before they got there and not rolled away until they were there watching.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
He was seen alive by over 500 people.
Amusingly, the 500 witnesses thing is often trotted out by apologists as if it's one of the strongest pieces of evidence for the resurrection, when it is in fact one of the weakest. If we look at that passage in context, it's Paul saying, no, really, it happened, trust me, like 500 people saw it too. And he names two of the people that Jesus supposedly appeared to. And this was in a letter that he was writing to a church in Corinth, which is in Greece, about events that took place near Jerusalem. It's not like any of the supposed witnesses were available for questioning. And if I were to leave it there, that would be really bad. That amounts to basically nothing. A guy wrote a letter saying, trust me, in this place that you'll probably never get a chance to visit, hundreds of people totally saw Jesus come back from the dead, is pretty worthless. But it gets even worse. Because, as it turns out, scholars pretty much universally agree that this part of Paul's letters to the church at Corinth is a creed, a passage that is typically recited aloud by believers to reaffirm their beliefs. In other words, it's not even Paul making that claim, he's repeating a claim that comes from a completely unknown source. Also, side note, how weird is it that religions have to have their followers recite their beliefs out loud in unison? Like, when you learn math, you don't all recite as a class.
Y equals mx plus b. Pi is equal to the circumference of a circle divided by its diameter. X equals negative b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac all over 2a.
For things that are real, you don't need to constantly reaffirm your belief in those real things. It's one of those things that you don't really think about if you grew up surrounded by that sort of thing, but in retrospect, it's just odd.
They heard him, touched him, saw him eat food, and work miracles.
Allegedly. The only direct eyewitness account of any post-resurrection appearance of Jesus that we have is from Paul, and he does not report any of those things. Actually, now that I think of it, I'm only aware of two instances in the entire New Testament when Paul himself actually reports any sort of experience with Jesus. In Galatians 1:12, he says that he did not receive the gospel from any man, nor was he taught it, but he received it through revelation of Jesus Christ. And that's it. He actually goes out of his way to ensure that we avoid thinking of this as a physical encounter with Jesus. He didn't get the gospel from a human, he got it from a revelation. And the only other mention that I'm aware of, and I am fully open to the possibility that there are mentions that I am unaware of, but I feel like they'd be easy to find. Given how sparse the evidence is, apologists would latch onto them without any hesitation. But the only other mention that I know of is the end of the Creed in 1 Corinthians, where he lists all the people that supposedly saw Jesus, and adds, "Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me." No reference to hearing him, touching him, watching him eat, or watching him perform miracles. Merely that he appeared. All that other stuff doesn't show up until another 15 to 20 years had passed. Actually, no, that's not accurate. That would be the case for Mark, but as far as we can tell, Mark originally ended at chapter 16, verse 8. An unnamed man told the women at the tomb to go tell the disciples that Jesus would meet them in Galilee. And then the women ran away and said nothing to anyone. It is widely thought that the man at the tomb was Jesus, but it is likely, given that the author of Mark had a penchant for literary devices, that the man was meant to be the same man who ran away naked at Jesus' arrest. Mark often sandwiched important events between seemingly trivial details, like the curse of the fig tree. Jesus sees a fig tree, gets mad at it for not producing figs out of season, curses it, then goes to overturn the tables in the temple, and on his way back the next day, he sees that the fig tree is withered. The bit about the fig tree makes him look irrational and ignorant. Of course the tree wouldn't produce fruit when that fruit is out of season. He got mad, he cursed it. But what's really going on here is the author of Mark is putting an emphasis on the ending of the Jewish temple cult, where animal sacrifices were required once a year. In 70 CE, the Romans destroyed the temple, leaving the Jews nowhere to perform these sacrifices. Christianity was one of the ways some Jews dealt with this loss, substituting the sacrifice of Jesus for the sacrifice of animals in the temple. Jesus cursing the fig tree is an allegory for God allowing the destruction of the temple and the resulting end of the temple cult. It's no longer the season for such sacrifices. The place for them has withered and died. Back to the young man at the tomb, there are only two places in the entire gospel where the author used that particular word to describe a young man. In chapter 16, verse 5, the young man at the tomb, and in chapter 14, verse 51, referring to the young man who ran away naked. These two young men serve as the bread of the sandwich where the arrest, execution, and resurrection of Jesus are the meat.
My manwich!
It is significant that the young man does not flee in Gethsemane until after all the disciples have already left. He followed Jesus longer than they did, but ultimately met an even more disgraceful end, as not only did he end up running away, but he was left naked, humiliated, and alone. Kind of similar to how Jesus ended up. But after the resurrection, the young man is now placed in a prominent position on the right hand of the tomb where Jesus was supposed to be, wearing a white robe. He has been redeemed and renewed in Jesus. At this point, Mark ends in the same way as it began, completing the ultimate gospel sandwich. It opens chapter 1 with a messenger preparing the way for the Lord, and ends chapter 16 with a messenger announcing the coming of the risen Christ. And it's fitting that the last person to abandon Jesus at his arrest is the first one to announce his return. Anyway, I'm a bit off topic. My point in bringing that up is to point out that Mark was using a lot of literary devices that didn't really fit in a literal story, so that's how we kind of know that the Gospel of Mark is mythological. So the original ending of Mark was likely the spot where this man tells the women to tell the disciples where Jesus would meet them, and so the first gospel to include any resurrection appearance of Jesus would be either Matthew or Luke, which would have been about 20 to 30 years after Paul was writing, and 50 years after the events that they purport to describe. So the earliest accounts that we have of anyone witnessing a risen Jesus in a physical sense, with them being allowed to touch him, watch him eat, etc., are clearly later additions to the story and didn't show up until long after it was possible to verify any of this with any actual eyewitnesses to the events.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Number two, these witnesses kept their testimony despite extreme persecution.
Yeah, I thought we were probably going to end up here. We actually don't know anything about the lives of the disciples post-resurrection. There are no reliable sources for any of them. The sources that we have for their deaths are incredibly dubious. Peter was allegedly crucified upside down, but the source for that also says that he healed his crippled daughter just to prove that he could, before unhealing her, with the reason for leaving her as a cripple being that, starting at 10 years old, she was just too sexy and would lead too many men astray. Gross. He also had a magic battle with a sorcerer named Simon, which culminated in Simon failing to raise a boy from the dead, and Peter succeeding. At his crucifixion, he was allowed to make a lengthy speech before being crucified in his preferred manner. Now, I'm no historian, but I feel like the Romans weren't exactly in the habit of allowing crucifixion victims to give long-winded speeches that would encourage others to continue in the work that they were being crucified for, right before being crucified in their preferred manner rather than just the way they always do it. This whole document that we get this from is considered apocryphal today. No detail from it is considered to be historically accurate by anyone, except for the execution of Peter, which gets admitted as church tradition. Andrew was supposedly also crucified, which we get from another apocryphal book, the Acts of Andrew, which nobody takes seriously with the exception of when it is being used as a source for the death of Andrew. And even then, you don't hear preachers talk about how he gave a 3-day-long sermon as he was dying on his cross. James, the brother of John, was executed by Herod. This is one of the better source deaths, with his death being found in the book of Acts. Though even if I grant it, it doesn't give us any specifics. It just says that he was put to death with a sword. No mention of him keeping to his story until the bitter end, with the promise that recanting would end his punishment, just that he was killed with a sword. John is sketchy at best, and I've already wasted too much time trying to hunt down the ultimate source of the church tradition that holds that he died of old age. Like, there are at least 3 dudes named John who could either be their own independent Johns or John of the 12, and even the earliest of the church fathers disagree about which ones are which. But since he's the one guy not claimed to be a martyr, it's ultimately not important for this case. Philip, depending on which source we use, either died of natural causes, beheading, stoning, or an upside-down crucifixion, with none of those sources being earlier than the late 2nd century, and the most widely used source being the Acts of Philip, which was written sometime in the 4th century. Bartholomew, depending on the source, was either flayed and beheaded, crucified, or beaten unconscious and drowned. Thomas, according to the 3rd century account Acts of Thomas, was stabbed with a spear. The earliest source we have from Matthew says that he died a natural death, but the later accounts differ on how he died, all agreeing that he was martyred, but the method could have been by stoning, stabbing, beheading, or burning, depending on which account we go with. James, the son of Alphaeus, who was maybe the same as one of the other Jameses, but also maybe not, was crucified in Egypt, according to Greek church tradition, with most competing traditions now widely believed to be an error and conflating him with James the Just, who was beaten to death with a fuller's club. For Simon and Jude, our source is a book that was written in the 10th century, as recorded by the Golden Legend, which was written in the 13th century. Apparently, they just got chopped up after casting out demons. But also, according to different sources, Simon was martyred in either Iberia, Persia, Samaria, Britain, or just died of old age in Edessa, and he was either crucified or sawed in half, depending on which source we're using. Matthias, the guy that replaced Judas, was either stoned by the Jews in Jerusalem, stoned by cannibals in Georgia, or died of old age in Jerusalem. So yeah, we have no reliable sources for any of the disciples, except maybe James the brother of John. All we have is church tradition, which often conflicts with itself. Every single one of these guys was lost to reliable history after the crucifixion of Jesus, and maybe even before then. In fact, I didn't even get into the fact that the very identities of these guys are uncertain. Even if we go with just the Bible, to list them, we have Simon, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Nathaniel, Thomas, Matthew, Levi, James, Thaddeus, Judas, not that one, Simon, and finally, that Judas. If you were counting along, that's 15 disciples, not 12. As early as the 2nd century, apologetics were being invented to combine names in order to get the number down to 12 when you read the 4 canonical Gospels together. Matthew and Levi became one person, as did Bartholomew and Nathaniel, and Thaddeus and not that Judas. And there is some precedent for this. After all, Jesus changed Simon's name to Peter. Except anytime there's a big name change like that, it's got a symbolic meaning. In this case, Simon had solved Jesus' riddle, so Jesus rewards him by making him the foundation of his church, with the accompanying name change to Rock. The other disciples just get paired up based on which names are missing from the other lists of the 12 disciples from the other books. It's never explained in the text that they are the same person, and we know so little about them that we're not actually justified in making that assumption. Also, side note, but it's interesting that Jesus said that he'd build his church with Peter as the foundation, and yet the first century person who undeniably had the biggest impact on the building of the Christian church was Paul, not Peter.
At first, all the disciples were full of doubt and afraid. But then something happened. They were motivated to publicly share their faith. They put out of the synagogue, leave all, travel to distant lands, and spread their faith around the world.
Yeah. It seems like a pretty powerful literary device, and a common trope in the Bible. To tie back to the man at the tomb, in Mark, he fled in fear, shame, and disgrace. But he ended up in a place of high esteem, on the right hand of Jesus, with his clothing transformed from common linens to white robes. People love a good redemption arc, that's nothing new. Is it really that shocking that the gospel authors wrote a redemption arc for them?
They were tortured and thrown in prison. Most faced death. Stephen was stoned. James was killed with a sword. Peter was crucified. But nobody, not one person, caved under pressure and confessed. We made it all up.
Given how shitty the sources are for their deaths, and the fact that you don't trust those sources for any other details about their lives, why should we trust those sources for their lack of recanting? I don't understand why this nothing burger always gets trotted out as evidence when we throw out literally everything the sources for these claims say, except for this one detail, for no better reason than they want it to be true. Seriously, someone explain to me why should we trust that Peter was actually martyred by being crucified upside down, but we should not trust the same source for that claim when it says that he intentionally left his daughter as a cripple because she was too sexy.
Number 3. The Gospels are filled with self-incriminating testimony.
Also known as the criterion of embarrassment. The criterion that starts with the assumption that we would actually know enough about the culture, life experiences, and personal disposition of the author of a text to say with a good deal of certainty what they would have considered to be embarrassing.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Jesus called Peter Satan. Peter often spoke before thinking. All the disciples were dull of hearing. They were all really prideful and argued about who was the greatest.
Yeah. Almost as though they were written as a literary device whose purpose was to have an audience insert where Jesus could explain his actions in an easy-to-understand manner without having to break the fourth wall. Like Watson in the Sherlock Holmes books. Basically, all he does throughout the whole books is exclaim, "Well, I say!" when Sherlock explains something clever. Watson is written to be a bit on the dull side, never quite picking up on the nuances of how Sherlock works, so that in every book, there's a reason why Sherlock is explaining everything in great detail. Story-wise, it's for Watson's benefit, but Watson serves as the window through which the audience views the story, giving an in-universe reason for everything to be constantly explained. The disciples are the Watson to Jesus Sherlock. They never learn, and they constantly need the same message explained to them over and over again. That is, until Jesus dies and they take over the role of religious leaders. That's when they suddenly become competent, when the whole story is supposed to come together to make sense as a cohesive whole. The reader is supposed to have a full understanding by that point as well, so the details are left rather vague for the most part. We just know that they continued spreading the gospel. We don't know a lot of the specifics.
And all abandoned Jesus at his arrest.
Yeah, and the two gospels that actually mention the disciples fleeing also explicitly mention that this happened so that the scriptures will be fulfilled. Almost like they had some sort of motivation to include that detail, even if it was embarrassing.
You just wouldn't say these things about yourself if you were making the story up.
They literally explain why they include those details in the story. Why do you think the authors of the Gospels would be embarrassed by scriptural prophecies being fulfilled? Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself.
Number 4. Extreme scoffers became extreme believers.
That's literally true of every religion. You can find Islamic apologists who are former Christian apologists. Wikipedia has a whole list of Christians who turned Hindu. Julia Roberts is actually on that list. I wasn't expecting that. She says she converted to Hinduism because it gave her real spiritual satisfaction. That's a very similar reason that a lot of Christians give for converting to Christianity. It finally fills that God-shaped hole in your heart. Well, Julia found that her heart hole was Vishnu-shaped. Now, this isn't to say that she was a scoffer of Hinduism. My point is merely that every major religion has adherents who claim that they were extreme scoffers or skeptics before they converted. So the existence of such people in Christianity is entirely mundane.
Jesus' own brothers didn't even believe in him before his resurrection, but after his resurrection, they believed.
Honestly, that sounds more like him having opportunistic brothers than true believer brothers. His closest family, the people who knew him the best in all the world, didn't believe that he was who he said he was. Until he died and they saw that there was a religion growing around the myth that he came back from the dead, seeing an opportunity to gain wealth and or power in this new religion, they suddenly have an encounter with the risen Christ. And keep in mind here that according to the Bible, Jesus had at least four brothers. Why did only two convert? Did Jesus not bother appearing to the other two? It seems like the real story here is that when two of Jesus' brothers started preaching about him having risen from the dead, the other two thought that they were either lying or delusional.
In fact, they even became leaders in the church.
Again, allegedly, according to really bad sources.
The Apostle Paul was another scoffer. He was a very wealthy and powerful Jewish Pharisee who persecuted the church. But after claiming to see the risen Jesus, he became its biggest supporter.
The only sources we have for Paul being a persecutor of Christians are Paul and the author of Luke, who got the story from Paul. Basically, all we know of Paul comes from Paul, either directly through his writings or indirectly through the author of Acts writing down what he said. And the interesting thing is, when we look at non-biblical sources that talk about the Pharisees and their beliefs, they were very similar to the kinds of messages that Jesus was said to have preached in the Gospels. The Jewish leaders that were often referred to as Pharisees in the Gospels would have aligned much more closely with the Sadducees, with the actual Pharisees focusing on things like redemption, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of good people with eternal punishment for the wicked, and so on. Like, this isn't to say that Paul was for sure not a Pharisee and for sure didn't persecute Christians before his conversion. It's just to point out that we're taking his word for it. That's our only source.
Number 5. Christianity started in the place where people were most familiar with the facts. If you were going to start a myth about the resurrection, you'd go as far away as possible from those who could disprove it.
You mean like maybe writing a letter to people in Greece that includes a reference to tons of people having witnessed the resurrection in Jerusalem, where the recipients of that letter would likely never visit? Like, really, if I start with the assumption that Christianity is at least based loosely on a real guy, it makes sense that it would start where he already accumulated a following. That's where the people that are already primed to believe in the kinds of things that he was saying are. Sure, not all of his followers are guaranteed to join the new movement, but some will. And really, given that the earliest Christian writings make no mention of a physically resurrected Jesus, there's nothing to disprove. How would one disprove Paul's vision? I myself have often granted that Paul could legitimately have had an experience that he interpreted as a vision from Jesus, and so he became an honest believer. As far as I'm concerned, that's not even a claim that's worth trying to disprove. Given that the accounts of the physical resurrection of Jesus weren't written until a time when even church tradition agrees that the vast majority of the disciples were already dead, there don't actually seem to have been any claims that would have been disprovable in circulation until the people that would have had the greatest ability to disprove them had died.
Now, Jesus was publicly crucified in Jerusalem, and that's exactly where the early church began.
Again, I see no reason to expect that the early church would not begin where the earliest believers lived. Even if the people living there could have disproved it thing were a legitimate consideration, just look at how many people believe things today that are easily proven false with a quick Google search. Like, the majority of my channel is videos responding to young Earth creationists. The young Earth has been pretty conclusively disproved at this point in history, and the information is readily available. And yet there are still hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, who believe that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old, even though there are living organisms that are older than that. Given how easy it is to find this information today, and that people still believe things that are easily proven false, why would we expect the people of ancient Jerusalem to have a degree of hyper-skepticism about their religious beliefs that would require significantly more effort than a Google search?
Here's the conclusion. There are only four possibilities regarding the resurrection of Christ. You could say it's a legend that crept in over time. But the problem with this view is legends take centuries to form, and the Gospels were written soon after the events they describe.
How long did it take for the legend of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 US election to form? That one was basically instantaneous. Within a month, articles questioning the story of JFK's assassination were being published, and the first full-blown conspiracy theory was published less than a year afterward, complete with legendary growth. The legend of Elvis having faked his death to go into hiding took less than a decade to develop, which is a shorter time span than the gap between Jesus' death and the very first of the Christian writings. So, no, legends do not take centuries to develop. They can happen right the fuck away.
You could argue the disciples lied intentionally, but what would motivate the disciples to lie?
Well, firstly, we don't have any writings from any of the disciples, and the only writings we have from anyone who knew any of them personally are Paul's writings, and he doesn't say much. Mainly in Galatians 2, he meets with the disciples and they agree that he had been given grace by God, and so they appoint him as their outreach to the Gentiles. And then he had a spat with Peter, because apparently Peter advocated for making the Gentiles live according to Jewish laws, but he himself was caught disobeying those laws. Now, to me, whether this account is true or not, this speaks to the idea that Paul was not inventing Christianity himself. It was a religion that already existed when he came on the scene, and had established leaders. So one of two things could have happened here. Either Paul made up the meeting in an attempt to use their names to build his own credibility, or, what seems more likely in my opinion, Paul actually did meet with some of them, and either did receive their blessing to evangelize to the Gentiles, or did not and were back to him just using their names to bolster his own credibility. Given that he only mentions James, Peter, and John, I see no reason to believe that the other disciples were still active at this point or had stuck around. It's possible that they did, but it's not necessary to explain the beginnings of Christianity.
Wealth, power, fame, most of them faced death, and all of them faced persecution.
We dealt with the death claims already, the evidence is severely lacking, but what about persecution? Was persecution a reasonable expectation for them? Because, yeah, they did get wealth and power. They were in charge of a quickly growing religion that had people donating all of their possessions to the church, which, again, they were in charge of. So what we really have to ask here is whether or not they would have had an expectation of persecution, and whether they would have considered their material gains to be worth that risk. And, of course, this only applies if we believe that they were just making shit up for the purposes of being in charge of the religion. If they sincerely believed what they were preaching, but were simply mistaken, then this becomes a moot point. And if Jesus was a real guy that they loved deeply, as the Bible suggests they did, then it's entirely plausible that three of the 12 disciples could have had a bereavement hallucination, an occurrence that is so common that as many as 60% of widowed spouses experience them. And that's just waking hallucinations. If we had dreams that leave you feeling like you're lost, loved one is still alive for a few minutes after you wake up, then honestly, three of the 12 guys experiencing something that convinced them that Jesus was still alive seems like it's on the low side.
You could say they were deceived, and Jesus never actually died, but someone stole the body. The problem with this is Jesus was publicly crucified by professionals, and the tomb was guarded.
Yeah, I've never put much stock in this one, but not because the tomb was guarded. A bunch of Roman soldiers at the tomb would have warranted a mention in more than just the one single gospel, that is also the one that explicitly states that the reason it's mentioning the soldiers is to combat the idea that the disciples stole the body. Well, you know what, okay, there is one other gospel that mentions the soldiers at the tomb. The apocryphal gospel of Peter, which also has Jesus emerge from the tomb as a giant with a talking cross as his sidekick. As a bonus? It's possible that this gospel, or at least parts of it, were written before any of the canonical gospels. So if that's the case, then you need to account for how a legend could have developed faster than you say it's possible for legends to develop. It most likely was written after them, but not by much. Most scholars agree that it was written in the first half of the second century, around the same time as the Gospel of John, but probably a little bit after John. Back on topic, the main reason I don't put much stock into swoon theory or the stolen body theory is because of what I said earlier about the body being left on the cross to rot before being thrown into a mass grave. Though, notably, those are not the only two ways the disciples could have been deceived. It could easily have been a self-deception, where they had hallucinations or dreams that they honestly believed were from a risen Jesus.
The last option, it's the truth. Jesus's resurrection is an event in history that really did happen. And that, for Christians, makes the most logical sense.
Fun fact, if it only makes the most logical sense to a group of people who already accept that as an a priori belief, then it probably isn't the option that actually makes the most logical sense. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Blem Wispillow, who says, "His glasses alone are proof that cooperation is a benefit to a species. Unless, of course, he invented plastics, discovered optics, diagnosed himself with discoveries he made, etc., etc., etc." Indeed, basically everything in your life is a result of social cooperation. Most people don't know how to build houses, for instance, and of those who do know how to build houses, they probably don't know how to manufacture the tools or materials that they use to build the house. I mean, hell, you can find content creators whose whole shtick is just them making everything, including the tools that they use, from scratch. But damned if they know how to manufacture the cameras and microphones that they use to film themselves doing that. So, yeah. In human society, cooperation is the name of the game, and better cooperation is what gives you the survival advantage. Thanks for watching, thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon and sponsorships manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, 713N, Michael Harbach, Ted Hegemon, Ben Leong, and all the rest, who are the apocryphal documents written around the same time as the canonical gospel that is my channel. If you'd like to be true, because legends just can't grow that fast, so everything written about the Jesus story in that time frame has to be true, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time!
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.